WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lieutenant Lucy Duval, is a good example of how women's roles have changed in police forces around the country. She joined the Cleveland Police Department in 1973. While she was still a rookie, she started working undercover as a prostitute to bust Johns. 5 years later, she was a member of a special strike force focusing on street crime, fraud, and hostage negotiations. She later became the first woman in the country to head a vice squad. Now she heads a recently created sex crimes unit. There's a new book about her called Working Vice. I spoke to Lieutenant Duval and asked her first about her early days on the force. She was in the first group of women in Cleveland allowed to go out on patrol. This was a result of a class action suit filed by members of the Women's Bureau. Lieutenant Duval told me that when she joined the force, the police stations weren't prepared for women.
The one that I was assigned to did not have a ladies' room. They didn't have any type of separate locker facility. So, you know, those kind of things they absolutely not prepared for. They didn't have a really good female officer uniform, because the uniforms that the women had worn before that consisted of skirts and blazers, and which, you know, would not be appropriate for street work. And so they didn't have a supply of uniforms for us. I was out on the street for several weeks, maybe up to a couple of months, I don't recall exactly, before I actually got a uniform.
What were you wearing until then?
Just regular, slacks and a jacket. I was sort of like a, misfit, I guess.
Yeah, undercover when you weren't supposed to be undercover.
Yeah, that was sort of it. I was sort of this strange person that was wearing, kind of regular practical clothing with a badge on the front of it.
So what'd you do for a ladies' room if there wasn't one?
My partner, who incidentally works in the sex crime unit for me now, he would stand at the door of the men's room and say, off limits for a minute, Lucy's in there. And a lot of times I would go to one of the area hospitals that, of course, we spent quite a bit of time anyway, getting reports and things. So, and I would use the facilities there.
Did you get a lot of resistance from the men on the force when you joined?
It's strange. I went out to the district that was the highest crime rate in the city and was the largest district and had a reputation for having some of the problems in the police department. It was kind of a, dumping ground. And so I expected a lot of resentment. What I found was certainly some resentment. There was no question about that. And it's like any other male-dominated profession. You're never going to get everybody, to embrace that concept of women on the job. But there were really a number of officers out there, the younger ones, who were not quite that ingrained with the idea of not allowing women in basic patrol. And there were a number of them who, even if they didn't like the idea, were at least willing to accept it and not try to put more obstacles in my way. But there were some that were resentful.
Now, I understand that the wives group, a group of wives of officers, resisted having women on patrol.
Well, apparently they did. Now, of course, I was never part of the, police auxiliary, and so I didn't attend any of their meetings. But there was certainly a faction of them that were just very concerned about what was going to happen and that their marriages were going to be put in jeopardy, and that, they were very concerned about what was going on in these zone cars, and now there were women out there. And, there was, absolutely some concern about that. I think, though, I don't recall anything really overt ever happening. And so I think some of it maybe was a little bit of hype as time went on, too. And it gradually that sort of just tapered off, I guess, when they found out that, nothing drastic. It really happened.
Mm-hmm. What was the first really big test for you, where you were in a confrontational situation, a violent situation?
Well, actually, I think one of the biggest tests for me didn't come from a situation of real violence. And maybe this speaks a little about, you know, what is frightening to different people. One of the first calls that we went on was to go into an abandoned funeral home after a man who allegedly had some mental problem and was carrying a shotgun. And I mean, it was scary in there. It was dark and all the heavy draperies and everything. It was really, you know, frightening to me. And I thought, my gosh, this is just, you know, pretty bizarre. And so that was when I realized that this was the kind of thing I was going to be doing. That had an impact on me. As far as some of the early situations of violence, they almost happen so quickly that it's all in retrospect that you start thinking about them. So while they're going on, you're just doing what you've been trained to do, and then it's kind of afterwards you'll look at it and think, wow, I'm glad that turned out the way it did.
Well, what was the first violent situation for you? Because you didn't know until that point what your reflexes would be.
Right. I think one of the first, probably, and I think this is recounted in the book, was with the in the schoolyard where I this man who was intoxicated and made some moves like he was trying to get close to me, and he made a grab at me, and I did exactly what I had been trained to do, which was just back him off with my nightstick. And we had been told and taught to, you know, you put your nightstick right in someone's chest and give, you know, a push, and that you really don't need an awful lot of strength to get them off balance, and, you know, they'll kind of topple over. And that was exactly what happened. And it made me feel good that I, you know, remembered all this stuff and was able to do it when I needed to. And, you know, it worked out real well. And there was no question that some of the other officers that were there on the scene, you know, it sort of opened their eyes a little bit to say, well, you know, maybe this isn't, you know, as bad as we thought. You know, maybe she can do something. So that was probably the first one, when somebody actually, you know, made a grab at me. And I'm not very large, and I have short arms, and we were always told not to let people get within arm's length of you.
Mm-hmm. You know. Not very large. You're 5'3", aren't you?
Yes.
And you weigh about 100 pounds?
Well, I did, Terry. Okay. You know, the years have, but we don't really need to go in.
Anyways, I know that 5'3" is not very small. It's not very tall. It's pretty short. I imagine that a lot of people would look at you and think, "Well, she'd be easy to overwhelm. I could take her easily." So did criminals ever try to take advantage of you, figuring that they could like knock you down and get away pretty easily?
I don't think so, because what I tried to indicate, and which I think maybe was almost an advantage in ways, was that, you know, clearly I wasn't going to be able to fight it out with somebody, you know, and get into some, you know, fisticuffs type thing. And that's, you know, not really what, you know, we were trained that much to do anyway. And I think people quickly perceived that I obviously wasn't going to be able to do that, and that I might be forced to shoot them.
Right, which I guess is a pretty strong message.
You know, so they would leap to something, you know, far more serious than what I had in mind. But I think that was an advantage, because people would just say, hey, wait a minute, you know, she's not going to let me deck her or something. You know, she's going to pull that gun out and shoot me.
Did you ever have to use your gun?
I've never had to shoot anybody. No, I've certainly had it out and ready. And we're trained in certain situations to have your weapon ready, should you need it, but I've never had to shoot anyone.
You went on the streets as a decoy prostitute when you were working in the vice squad before you became the head of it. What exactly did you have to do?
Well, basically, we sort of stood around and waited for a John, as they're referred to solicit us. And because, of course, legally, the decoy can't make the first move and can't initiate the conversation. Mm-hmm. It has to be clear that the John is doing the soliciting. So you sort of kind of stand around and wait for somebody to approach you, usually in their car. You know, they'll pull up beside you on, you know, on the sidewalk. And so, and let them take the lead in the conversation, and so that it's clear that they are, you know, soliciting for you for sex and that they are willing to pay a certain amount of money.
So did you ever get into a tight spot with a John who was soliciting you?
Yeah, I got into, you know, a few. One in particular was probably the one that turned out to be potentially what could have been the most dangerous, and had to start thinking about the tactics that we were using. And a man picked me up. He solicited me, and at the time we were having the decoys would get in the car with the John, and when we got in the car, that was the signal to our backup that was watching us that we had been, you know, solicited. And then the backup car would follow us down the street with the idea that then they would just pull us over, you know, just like a regular vice car, and pull us over and, you know, arrest the male. Well, in this particular incident, the guy just didn't pull over, and the car got lost in traffic. I tried turning around in the seat, and I couldn't really see the backup car. And I kept suggesting to the guy, well, let's pull into this alley, you know, let's pull into this parking lot. And he just kept driving down, you know, one of the main thoroughfares in Cleveland, going out of the city. And the conversation that was evolving made it very clear to me that this was not some John. He was a pimp who had seen a new girl out on the stroll and, you know, was going to, you know, put her to work for him. And, you know, wasn't really interested in taking no for an answer. So he finally did pull in, and the backup, fortunately, when they came through traffic, they did see that we had pulled in, and we were able to get him under arrest. But after that, and that man, incidentally, had a long history of violence, and subsequently was the victim of a homicide on the street. He was killed by another pimp or something. So after that, we took a hard look at this idea of the police when I'm actually getting into the cars, you know, and we started making some changes. And then when, you know, later on, we just didn't do that at all because it wasn't safe.
Yeah, I could see. I could see that.
I began to see that real quick. I was thinking, this is not a good idea.
My guest is Lieutenant Lucy Duvall. She's the subject of a new book called Working Vice. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Lieutenant Lucy Duvall, and she now heads the Sex Crimes Unit in Cleveland for the police force. There's a new biography of her called Working Vice. Now, you founded the Sex Crimes Unit that you now head. Why did you feel like this unit was needed?
Well, the city council, our city council here in Cleveland, and the police chief, and I think primarily the chief at the time, felt that because of all the concern there was about child sexual abuse at the time, and, you know, and that we were looking very hard at, you know, closely at some of these issues, that the department, you know, to keep current in the profession, needed a specialized unit to handle these types of investigations and to handle the felony sex crimes committed against adults as well. And I had already acquired some background in child pornography. I had been working on those kinds of investigations and had had some training in them. And he felt that I would be a good person to put in charge of that unit.
You've been involved in the investigations of serial rapists. Can you tell us briefly about one case and how the person was apprehended?
Sure. I can tell you about, you know, one of the infamous ones in the city of Cleveland went on for the longest period of time. Man had been active in the west side of Cleveland and in some of the adjacent suburbs for several years prior to my even having the sex crime unit. And at that time, the district detective bureaus were handling those investigations. And had realized that there appeared to be one man had been committing a number of crimes, up to about, 30-some at that point. When he started, and soon after we started the sex crime unit, he, started hitting again. And it was so frustrating because he kept hitting and hitting, and initially we had nothing. We had no clues at all. The victims were sketchy as to their descriptions, and we were just at a brick wall. So one of the things that had been noted about him is that he did have some abnormality on his penis, and so we did start trying to zero in on that and trying to determine what that might be as a means of identification. And, we went from there then we went to the media. They were very helpful with the case. And as, unfortunately, we got a few more victims, we were able to put together a good composite drawing based on the recollections of several of the victims. And subsequently, finally learned who this man was. And once we got his name, we still didn't know where he was. He didn't have a permanent address anywhere. And our local NASA helped us enhance a bank photograph. This guy started getting a little careless, and he started grabbing bank cards from the victims, and then he would go, to get fast cash. And one of the bank cameras took a picture of his car. Now, it wasn't a very good picture, but the people at NASA said, we went to them and they said, we have wonderful equipment out here that we can enhance these photographs. They're the ones that we use to enhance the photographs that are taken by the space satellites. And so they did that, and we were able to see damage and stuff on the car that we couldn't have seen in the regular photograph. And one of the people up in our forensic lab, actually the superintendent up there, spotted the car. Just a great piece of luck, which all investigations need a little bit of luck along the way. And I sent some guys out to just wait for this guy to come back, and sure enough, he did, and we got him. But it was years. I mean, we are talking years of ongoing, just dogged investigative work, just bit by bit by bit of running down little bits of information.
At the risk of, what was the abnormality on his penis?
Well, it turned out that he had venereal warts, and but initially it was none of the victims could describe it in ways, but they couldn't really liken it to anything. Some victims said it appeared to be a scar tissue. Some victims said it appeared to be a wart. So what we did as part of our investigative process is we got a drawing just of a penis, and we let the victims draw on it where it was placed and what to them it appeared like, and that gave us some help. When I started, I talked to a couple of doctors about what it might be, and I found out that venereal warts can sort of come and go. They could be treated, and they disappear, and then they might come back. So we realized then that this might not be the great clue that initially mm-hmm. it was thought to be, because he might not always have it.
Right. So did it help you?
Yeah, it did actually. By the time they get down to the trial, and they found out that in fact he had venereal warts, and they had in fact come and gone at various times throughout this whole period that he had been raping. So it did tie in, and it made a wonderful, piece of evidence later on.
Do you miss being on the street? I don't mean as a decoy prostitute.
Yeah, no,
just as a as a police officer on the street.
Yeah, I do sometimes, but I'm kind of fortunate because in the position that I'm in now, I still go out on some investigations, uh-huh. And I enjoy doing that. Now I cannot take on an investigation and be the primary investigator because I can't get myself tied up in lengthy trials and stuff. I wouldn't get the rest of my work done. But I am able to go out on some investigations and do a little street work, and I do get still pretty actively involved in the child pornography investigations that we do. So, I keep that little outlet. So when I get that urge to, go out there and be a real policeman, I'm still able to do it.
Right.
Because I do
enjoy
it.
There's a bunch of photographs in the book about you working vice. And in one of the photographs, you're opening up your locker, and inside the locker is a large poster of a naked man from a Playgirl magazine.
Right.
Did you put that up in response to male officers having naked women in their lockers, or what?
Pretty much, and I did it really as a joke, because it was so funny, because there was no female locker room in this old district station. So they gave me a locker, but it had to be in the men's locker room. There wasn't any other place to put it, so there was an empty locker that they gave me to put my equipment and stuff in, so I didn't have to take everything I owned home with me every night. I normally just wore my uniform back and forth to work with a, you know, coat or something overnight, because there wasn't any place for me to really change clothes. But I did keep my equipment there, and the first day I walked into the locker room, I'd never walked into a men's locker room before. It was a little awkward, you know. I just kind of stood at the door and said, you know, I'm coming into the locker room. And I could see all these, you know, similar things in the guys' lockers. And, you know, mine really looked, no pun intended, naked in comparison. And so I thought it might ease the tension a little bit. And I grabbed one of these magazines. And actually, the first one I had was when Burt Reynolds was in Cosmopolitan. And I just tacked and just, you know, taped it up in the door of my locker. And I said, you know, I just kind of want my locker to look like everybody else's.
So what kind of reactions did you get?
They just laughed, and it did really kind of break the ice. And they saw that I wasn't coming in there as a feminist and a women's liber, and, you know, expect them to change everything to accommodate me, because that wasn't my intention, as I didn't think that was the way to, you know, that would have just put another obstacle in my path, I think.
Lieutenant Lucy Duvall heads the sex crimes unit of the Cleveland Police Force. She's the subject of the new book, Working Vice. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.